From Connecticut to Arizona, New Jersey to Iowa, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, federal regulations add $14,600 per year to the cost of goods and services purchased by the average American family. Wayne Cruz of the Competitive Enterprise Institute is here with details. The candidates are now set for a special congressional election in North Carolina. It looks like it will be the most competitive federal race of the year. Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth has the real story. The Export-Import Bank is now back at full speed. What impact will that have on the economy? Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Veronique Narugi of the Mercatus Center. And Democrat demands for President Trump's tax returns are theater without substance. So says Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, on this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Talk about federal regulations, and most folks think they're just a problem for business. But the cost gets passed down to the consumer, and it is a substantial drag on the U.S. economy. Here with details and a new report is Wayne Cruz. Wayne is Vice President for Policy and a Senior Fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Wayne, welcome to American Radio Journal. Wayne, when we talk about the federal regulatory burden that is on not only business, and I know a lot of people think that this is only an issue for businesses, but it really impacts every American, every family. Before we talk about the specific numbers in your new report, tell us a bit about the scope of the regulatory burden that we have in this country.
I have always thought that when we talk about the federal deficit and the growing debt, that if we're missing the impact of regulations on the public, that's environmental, health and safety, economic, and all the paperwork. If we miss all of that, we're really missing the biggest part of government's impact in the economy. It helps, I believe, to think of regulations as a hidden tax, because we can look up in the historical tables and see exactly what the federal budget is, what the debt is, what the deficit's going to be this year, which is back up at record levels, by the way. But you can't do a similar thing for regulations. And what I like to try to do is try to put a map on that hidden tax and show the scope of it in terms of its costs, if we can, the numbers of rules and regulations compared to what Congress does. And if you were to take those regulatory costs down to the family, I like to try to show how much that is. So that's kind of an overview, if that helps.
That helps a lot. So we now know a bit about the scope, and we're going to talk in more detail about that in a couple of minutes. But at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, you have produced a new report, 10,000 Commandments, an annual snapshot of the federal regulatory state. Tell us a bit about this report. What is it that you're trying to get to in this report? What information are you trying to put together and impart to the American public? And how did you go about doing that?
The way this came about is when I had gone to graduate school, I was going to study economics. I was going to work in finance or banking, but I took an interest in public policy, and so many people were doing tax and budget issues. And the Competitive Enterprise Institute, where I am, had been founded in 1984, George Orwell's year. And the emphasis there was the regulatory state, the administrative state, or the deep state in the current parlance. And I started to put together some figures on the scope of regulation. I'd started a report. It's now, gosh, in the 26th year since I've done it at CEI. So everybody's getting old. But I pulled together the cost of regulations, which I use a placeholder of about $2 trillion a year based on a lot of the government's own numbers and the very few, surprisingly, private sector studies out there that you can find. But if you think of $2 trillion, that's more than the personal income tax and the corporate income tax combined. So it's a huge number. If $2 trillion, if the regulatory state were a country, it would be the ninth largest country in the world between Russia and Canada. India and Canada, that is. Last year was Russia. So it's an enormous amount. If you take that down to the family level, you're looking at a little bit under $15,000 a year for the family. So that means it's bigger than every item in the family budget except for housing. So transportation, clothing, savings, all those other good things are less than that cost of the administrative state. So if what we hope is that policymakers track those costs, but guess what? They don't. They're supposed to assess benefits and costs of regulations. When I took a look at that, it's less than 0.5% of all the federal regulations. And guess what? There are over 3,000 of them every year. So it's less than 0.5% of those federal regulations that have cost-benefit analysis. So you see what I'm getting at. There's all this scope of all these different kinds of regulations that the government's involved in. And, you know, it's involved in everything from your gas can up to the Waters of the United States rule, up to greenhouse gas rules. It's involved in everything. But you find very, very little assessment, and even worse, you find very, very little accountability for it. And in terms of solving this issue, Congress is going to have to take back its authority to make laws rather than these unelected regulators doing it.
As we look at the Trump administration now, Wayne, there has been actually cuts in regulations, but the Trump administration also is doing some new regulatory efforts, are they not?
Right. It's a little bit of a mixed bag, but on the whole, it's still positive, but it could easily change. Initially, when Trump came in, he and the Republican Congress at the time, now it's a Democratic Congress, but the first thing they did was roll back a series of Obama-era so-called midnight regulations. As it happens, there's something called the Congressional Review Act that lets Congress revoke or do a resolution of disapproval on a new regulation within 60 days. Of course, they rarely do that because under a given president, that just typically doesn't happen. But the administration did that. He's also succeeded in what he had called the two-for-one program. He said, okay, for every regulation agency's issue, they have to get rid of two. And so far, he's done that the first year, and in a technical sense, because a lot of the rules and regulations roll back that way, they wouldn't necessarily jump to the front of your mind as big rollbacks. If you want to roll back the huge rules like Clean Power Plan or the FCC's net neutrality rule, big rules like that, you have to go through an entirely new notice and comment process. But that is underway. It just takes a long, long time. One of the problems with the administrative state is you can't get rid of a regulation. You can only write a new one. So that's one of the downsides that makes reform different. So those positive developments are happening. And probably perhaps the biggest one was just the freeze on regulations that has occurred. The agencies typically aren't undertaking big new regulatory initiatives. There are some exceptions to that, though, and that's something we'd noted in the new 10,000 Commandments report. The president has a lot of debate over trade right now. Of course, that's one of the issues, and free market purists have a lot of problems with tariffs and trade. But Trump is a big proponent of that, and then there are additional distortions that have to go along with that, like the subsidies to farmers to make them whole. And he's also called for new antitrust regulation, which in the free market side, the small L libertarian community might say have got real problems with antitrust intervention in the economy. It's one of the worst kinds of intervention.
We have been talking with Wayne Cruz, who is Vice President for Policy and a Senior Fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. And Wayne, tell us just a little bit about the Competitive Enterprise Institute and where on the web can folks go to read 10,000 Commandments and other publications of CEI?
Well, thank you very much. We're at CEI.org, very simple, CEI.org. And CEI, this happens to be the 35th anniversary year. Fred Smith founded CEI in 1984. The emphasis is and has always been on the regulatory enterprise.
Wayne Cruz of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Wayne, thank you for taking time to be with us today.
It was very much my pleasure. Have a wonderful day.
Scott Parkinson is at the Club for Growth, and Scott, of course, keeps an eye not only on what's happening in Congress, but also on what's happening in congressional and U.S. Senate elections around the country. We do have a result of a special primary in North Carolina. We're going to talk about that. Scott, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
We talked about this before, Scott. Do you want to tell us, to refresh our listeners' memory, what the district is, why we have this special election, and now we have nominees?
It's the 9th Congressional District of North Carolina. This was a seat where a Republican named Mark Harris beat Robert Pittenger in a very, very close Republican primary. Pittenger was an incumbent, wasn't an open race, and he went into the general election and faced a guy named Dan McCready. In the end, Mark Harris won a very, very tight election, but there were accusations of ballot harvesting and election fraud. So they refused to certify the election, and Democrats refused to seat Mark Harris. So what the state went ahead and did was schedule a special election for this week on May 14th. And we got lucky. We had a very, very strong candidate with state senator named Dan Bishop. Senator Bishop easily won the Republican primary and avoided a runoff election that would have been really costly, as the Democrat Dan McCready was unopposed. So the Club for Growth had endorsed State Senator Dan Bishop in the race, and we hope that the voters in North Carolina's 9th Congressional District will unite behind his candidacy, because we think that he's a fighter for economic freedom, individual liberty, and fiscal responsibility, while McCready is really just going to be advancing the socialist agenda of Nancy Pelosi, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and the likes. We contributed directly through our membership over $85,000 to his winning campaign, and then we also spent another $138,000 on independent expenditures to help boost him and in positive messaging, and also kind of exposing some of his opponents in the Republican primary that had some pay-to-play issues, and also there was a moderate that the Realtors PAC was trying to buy the race with over $1 million spent. Didn't work for her. She didn't even get 10% of the race. So Dan Bishop will be facing Dan McCready on September 10th. That'll be the final for the special election, and Club for Growth will be heavily engaged. I actually think, Loman, this is going to be the premier special election that the state party infrastructure, that the national party, with the National Congressional Committee, Trump, all of them have to get involved here to maintain this Republican seat. I bet you this one's going to probably cost in the range of $15 million. It's in the Charlotte market and going to be a very, very tight special election against McCready.
And that, of course, very different than what's happening in a special election we have coming up in just a couple of days in Pennsylvania 12, where Tom Marino, the congressman, resigned largely for health reasons back in January. President Trump due there on Monday to campaign, Scott. And that special election really hasn't become very competitive, has it?
No, and part of it is because we have a solid conservative in Fred Keller that represents the district well. Fred Keller has been a smart, effective legislator in Harrisburg, and I think that's why he's running away with this one. I'd expect him to win by more than 20 points.
That is a likely outcome, and of course, we'll report on that next week as well. Now, let's talk for a couple of minutes here about the federal spending debt limit. And this is something we touched upon last week. We're going to keep a very close eye on it. There is a limit, theoretically, to the amount of debt that Congress and the United States Treasury can engage in. There are efforts to change that. What is happening on that front?
On March 1st, the debt limit suspension ended, meaning now the Treasury Department is incurring what are called extraordinary measures. Extraordinary measures help the Treasury avoid a default on our debt obligations by selling off other U.S. assets to help cover these payments. The issue here is that it's sort of like pushing the ball down the field, kicking the can down the road, and it doesn't do anything to address the debt issue. And then they go as long as they can with these extraordinary measures, and then they say, well, we can't have a default on our national debt obligations, so we need to increase the debt limit or suspend the debt limit once again. I think that'll be a big part of a negotiation here on spending in Washington. Could be as early as July or as late as September. The problem that I have with it, to be honest, is that when you go and try to engage the House Republican leadership, the Senate Republican leadership, the rank-and-file offices, people act like they don't care. And the reason that this is important is because soon enough, our national debt interest payments alone are going to exceed the total amount that we spend on national defense. That's why the national debt is the greatest threat to our nation. We all believe in a strong national defense, but we also want to be using our money smartly and not overly taxing the U.S. American worker. So as we get into this situation here where a debt limit increase or a debt limit suspension happens, I'd certainly encourage anybody that's an activist to call up their member of Congress and ask them where they stand. What reforms are they looking to make on federal spending to reverse the debt and deficit situation that we're faced with? What are they going to do so that our debt obligations don't force even the worst positioning with competitive interests in China? So we have to think about that in the long term. This is not an issue that's going to be going away anytime soon. We obviously have $22 trillion in the national debt. Big, big concern there. The last thing that I would say is we're approaching another spending agreement on the budget caps. Club for Growth has been working with conservatives, fiscal conservatives in Washington, to try to hold to the caps. Congressman Chip Roy from Texas 21st Congressional District has been leading that effort, and we have actually over 36 members that have fiscal sanity, if you can believe it, and have pledged to opposing a caps deal. We're trying to grow that number. I think we can get it to over 100 in the House. We also have 2 United States senators that have joined us in that pledge, Mike Lee from Utah and Rand Paul from Kentucky.
And we will continue to keep an eye on that. Obviously, an issue that we're going to be talking about through the summer and into the fall. We have been talking with Scott Parkinson, who, of course, is with the Club for Growth. And Scott, a little bit about the club.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization of over 250,000 Americans. You can actually join the Club for Growth for free. And I would encourage everybody to check us out on our website, www.clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
The Export-Import Bank now has a full complement of board members, and that means it can resume making large loans. But should it? Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine learns more from Veronique Darugi of the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Eric?
Back in July of 2015, when Congress allowed the Export-Import Bank's charter to expire, it looked like a big victory against crony capitalism. Congress, it seemed, had finally come to view that the federally backed financial institution was a liability rather than a boost to business. And of course, it was full of cronyism on the side. But now the Export-Import Bank is back and worse than ever. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Veronique Darugi. She is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center and a columnist for Reason Magazine, and her latest piece is about Congress's decision to reauthorize the Export-Import Bank. The headline, Congress just restored the Export-Import Bank. It still deserves to die. Veronique Darugi, thanks for taking some time and joining us here on the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Before we get into what happened with Congress last week, Vera, why don't we just take a quick step back here for people that may not be familiar with the Export-Import Bank. What is it? What does it do?
So the Export-Import Bank is an export credit agency, and its purpose is to boost U.S. exports. That's first and foremost its official goal. And it does it by basically extending a direct loan, guaranteed loans, mostly to foreign buyers of American products, and to also extending working capital and insurance products that is mostly to actually American companies.
And it's basically, these are just subsidies that it's handing out to big companies. Boeing, for example, benefits overwhelmingly.
Yes, it does. So because the terms of the loans are very favorable, so they on the foreign side, for instance, if you take any airline, whether it's Air China or whatever, they get a loan from EXIM, and it's a private loan, but it's guaranteed by the federal government, and it has effectively much lower rates, better terms. On average, some people have calculated it's a borrowing cost saving of roughly $20 million. So it's not cheap change, right? It's a form of subsidy for sure.
So back in 2015, this was something, this was a fight that went on for a while, actually, and it was one of the real big victories of the Republican Congress back when the Republicans in Congress were somewhat fiscally responsible. It was a fight that went on for a while, as I said, and it ended up with the EXIM Bank not being fully unauthorized, but there were some vacancies on the board, and basically there were limitations put on how much money the bank could loan out. It couldn't give out loans of more than $10 million. Now all that has changed. Congress has decided to reverse itself. What happened, basically? What does this mean for the EXIM Bank going forward?
Yeah, well, so it went away for 5 months. We forget that. 5 months. And then when a charter was reauthorized in, December of 2015, it still couldn't work at full capacity because it lacked a quorum, like enough board members to allow the bank to extend deals above $10 million. And as it happened, it was a pretty big deal because deals above $10 million was a vast majority of XM's activity. So I just wrote a paper with Justin Leventhal here at Mercatus, and we look at basically what's happened in the last 4 years. And we looked at whether exports like just went down significantly. We looked at what happened to the companies that weren't getting it, what happened to where was the money going before and what is going now. And it's pretty shocking that the Senate basically went ahead and restored everything, because what we found is like it had no impact on exports whatsoever. But we also looked at what countries we used to subsidize. And to our surprise was actually, in 2014, the biggest country destination for XM money was China, of all places. And it was like 11% of the activities were going to China. And so when you have an administration who is basically arm-twisting the senators to reauthorize XM to restore its full potential and arguing that it's a national security imperative to fight China, it's really bizarre, because you have an administration that effectively is saying, hey, let's subsidize Chinese company. Oh, and by the way, they're all state-owned companies, and that will be good to fight China. It makes zero sense whatsoever.
We are chatting with Veronique DeRougy. She's a senior research fellow over at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, and she's an expert on crony capitalism and corporate welfare, all of which is why she writes and talks so much about the Export-Import Bank. It's something that she's obviously very passionate about. Veronique, just about a minute left here. We don't have a lot of time, but I mean, why did Congress decide to do this now after a number of years where the XM Bank was sort of sidelined? Was this pressure from the administration? I mean, why this sudden reversal?
They have really no good reason. I think the administration is a big part of it, the misguided understanding that exports are good and not understanding that actually XM will do nothing. And it's just pure cronyism. And you have Boeing and GE and all these guys who love, it's not that they can't do without it. They can totally do very well without it. But wouldn't you want to have a really seriously discounted loan for your customers? Especially because usually those big companies, then they have a part in actually guaranteeing or entering like loans to even to their clients. So it's like basically an XM Bank is shifting the risk away from the private sector towards taxpayers, and all these big companies love it.
And so, unfortunately, the fight against the Export-Import Bank will have to continue and really in some ways has to start all over again from scratch 5 years after it looked like a big victory had been scored. The fight will continue, and Veronique DeRougy will continue to tell us about it periodically, I'm sure. Veronique, thanks so much for taking some time and being here on the show.
Very welcome.
And again, that's Veronique DeRougy, Senior Research Fellow over at the Mercatus Center. Check out her latest paper about the Export-Import Bank at Mercatus.org or her column that's up this week at Reason.com. Congress just restored the Export-Import Bank. It still deserves to die. That's at Reason.com. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch us right back here next week again on another edition of American Radio Journal.
President Trump has already filed a federal financial disclosure that is more detailed than the personal tax returns Congress is demanding. Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, explains on this American Radio Journal commentary.
The Mueller report is complete. Liberals did not hear what they wanted to hear, so they are waging a different type of battle. The battle will likely drag the 2016 election out for what seems like an eternity in some apparent misguided effort to turn back time and reverse the election results of that November night over 2 years ago. The new battle centers on Donald Trump's tax returns. The tax return conundrum and the demand that the president release his tax returns has exploded in both the New York State Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives. The New York Senate has cleverly attempted to circumvent the confidentiality of the tax return by introducing a bill authorizing the release of the returns. New York Senate Bill S-2271 requires the disclosure of tax returns by statewide elected officials, including the President of the United States. Governor Cuomo has indicated he would sign the bill. Not to be outdone, Congressman Neal, Democrat of Massachusetts, chair of the Ways and Means Committee, U.S. House of Representatives, stated in a press release, and I quote, "Last month, the Ways and Means Committee began an investigation into the mandatory audit program at the IRS in an effort to assess the extent to which the IRS audits and enforces the federal laws against the sitting president and to determine if those audits need to be codified into federal law. As part of that inquiry on April 3rd, I requested 6 years of the president's personal and business tax returns pursuant to my authority under Section 6103F of the IRS Code. I believe then, as I do now, that reviewing the requested documents is a necessary piece of the committee's work, unquote. The New York Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives are vainly attempting to politicize the release of tax returns, using the average American's misunderstanding of the tax code to give the false impression of wrongdoing on the part of the President of the United States. Any CPA, of which I am one, will tell you that there is limited value to viewing someone's personal tax return if your goal is to get a full picture of the individual's financial dealings. The nature of tax laws is so complicated that unless one understands all the intricacies of C-corporations, trusts, annuities, real estate, subchapter S entities, limited liability corporations, and partnerships, a review of an individual's personal tax return will merely give you an unbelievably inaccurate perspective of a person's financial dealings and holdings. Unfortunately, the tax laws are so complicated that a review of the tax return may actually be misleading in and of itself. Asking for personal tax returns seems reasonable and prudent when, in fact, it is irrelevant for the most part. These nuances in tax returns is precisely why the financial disclosure forms required by federal officials, including the president, are far more detailed and offer a much more comprehensive look at a person's financial dealings, interests, and potential conflicts of interest. The president of the United States, Donald Trump, has complied with all such financial disclosure. But that does not seem to make good press for those seeking headlines in the New York Senate or the U.S. Congress. The tax return controversy surrounding the liberals' demand of Donald Trump center on two critical issues, confidentiality and transparency. The first issue to consider is that the tax return is confidential for every American, not just the President of the United States. For the IRS, Department of Treasury, or state to release it without the appropriate laws in place would compel a release that may in fact be criminal. The governing law is 26 U.S. Code Section 6103. As a CPA, should I release a client's tax returns without proper authorization or legal action, I would be subject to disciplinary action and civil suit, which is under Section 1.700 of the AICPA Code of Professional Ethics. There are some who cite a 1924 law which gives congressional committee chairs the authority to request demand tax returns, but only if there is a legitimate legislative purpose, and if done, would be done in a closed executive session. There is a substantial body of thought which believes that the Supreme Court will have to answer that question. The second is that any public official in federal service is required to provide a comprehensive financial statement for public scrutiny. The President of the United States financial statement is over 92 pages long, excluding volumes of attachments. It is extraordinarily thorough and provides substantially more information than any tax return would possibly disclose. The unintended consequence of all this hoopla relating to President Trump's tax return is that it is merely a distraction. It is a distraction that the president knows is meaningless. Many people have contended that there have been decades of precedent in which former candidates for the presidency and former presidents have released their tax returns. Perhaps they released their returns because they knew it was little to no value. It seems to satisfy the public, and they can move more freely without interference from the public they supposedly serve. Perhaps President Trump is once again bursting a myth of transparency because he knows the issue is not real. Perhaps real reform will occur when the senseless laws are replaced with ones which really provide protection for the American people. Perhaps the president is merely draining the swamp one more time. For the American Radio Journal, this is Frank Ryan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliate, 105.7 FM in Thousand Oaks, California. Welcome to our new listeners in the Golden State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations which underwrite the cost of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.